Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Dr. Robert Atkinson, President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, or ITIF. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Coming off its recess, the Senate is working frantically to finalize spending bills for fiscal year 2020, which begins October 1st, to avoid another government shutdown. It's off to a rocky start, however, as the Senate, so far, has produced none of its 12 annual bills. There's also no bipartisan agreement on subcommittee allocations for the 12 bills, and without that agreement, the process is more likely to hit partisan gridlock. Both parties are likely to come to the table with their own alternative allocations later this week. The Senate was hoping to avoid these increased tensions in the final sprint of fiscal year 2019. But partisan stalemates may just get worse as the September 30th deadline approaches, especially with the biggest annual bills like defense and labor HHS education getting taken up this week, as well as bills like energy, water, and state foreign operations, followed by the military construction VA bill and Homeland Security. The goal is to advance four bills each week for the next 3 weeks. Issues like foreign aid, diverted funds, and border wall funding could be sticking points. Some hope that a provision in the recent two-year budget deal prohibiting poison pill riders could help smooth the process. Even without such amendments, the president's recent diversion of funds to a border wall has caused the delay of 127 military construction projects, impacting everything from child care centers to bases. And it's likely to spark outrage while defense spending legislation is being considered. The gun control debate is also likely to impact appropriations processes as elected leaders push for funding on federal research concerning gun violence. Few have hope the entire process, with legislation passed into law, is even possible to be completed by the end of the month. The House has to rewrite most of its bills, which passed on party line votes because they violate the new discretionary spending levels set in the recent budget deal. Thus, at least a short-term continuing resolution is likely on the horizon. In fact, there's already talk that one will be passed, pushing deadlines back to November. If it comes to fruition, it seems the White House has several wish list items it would try to attach to a continuing resolution, such as aid to farmers hurt by tariffs and extra money for the 2020 census. Congressional leadership has other plans, expecting to take up a, quote, clean stopgap measure. Legislation aimed at helping troubled pension plans may only end up being a Band-Aid, merely delaying their projected insolvency, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The bill would enable the Treasury to provide certain pension plans 30-year loans, but CBO said a quarter of the pension plans that would receive those 30-year loans would likely go insolvent within the 30-year repayment period, meaning they'd not fully repay the loans, while most of the remaining plans would likely become insolvent within 10 years after the 30-year period. Union pension plans covering 1.4 million people are expected to become insolvent over the next two decades. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Dr. Robert Atkinson, President of ITIF, will join me to discuss Dr. Atkinson's recent paper explaining why federal R&D policy needs to prioritize productivity to drive growth and reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Dr. Robert Atkinson and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Dr. Atkinson is the founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, a top think tank for science and technology policy. He's an internationally recognized scholar and a widely published author. Dr. Atkinson has testified many times before Congress and appears frequently on news and public affairs programs. He was appointed by President Clinton to the Commission on Workers, Communities, and Economic Change in the New Economy. President Bush appointed him chair of the congressionally created National Surface Transportation Infrastructure Financing Commission. And President Obama appointed him to the National Innovation and Competitiveness Strategy Advisory Board. He serves on a variety of committees and councils, holds a PhD in city and regional planning from the University of North Carolina. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Dr. Atkinson.
Oh, thank you, Chase. It's really a pleasure to join you.
Good to be back.
Happy to have you both on the show, and I'd like to discuss a pretty important topic. It actually goes back to a report that you just wrote, Dr. Atkinson. It's called Federal R&D Policy Needs to Prioritize Productivity to Drive Growth and Reduce the Debt-to-GDP Ratio. And it's a pretty heady topic that has a lot packed into it. So maybe to kick off this conversation, you can give a quick high-level summary of what is covered in this particular report beyond what's said in the title, and maybe why it's timely.
Sure, absolutely. So as Bob and the Concord Coalition have shown and done so much on through their hard work on the budget debt budget crisis, we're facing a budget debt, a national debt crisis. The debt to GDP ratio is going to go from about 40% in the 2000s up to about 100% and by 2028. That's driven by more retirees, a whole set of things. While raising taxes and cutting spending is important, sometimes that's hard to do. But one place that we can and should be focusing on is to reduce the debt to GDP ratio, which is really the most important ratio. How much debt do we have compared to how big our economy is? And so if you can boost GDP faster, you obviously improve the denominator, GDP, but you also reduce debt because you get more money coming into the federal coffers just from economic growth. How do we do that? Well, the evidence shows very, very clearly that one of the principal ways to do that is by driving productivity growth. Just think about 100 years ago, a lot of workers were working on a farm. Tractors weren't, we didn't have very many tractors, didn't have good seeds. Innovation, technological innovation made agriculture super productive, and now like 2% of workers are working on the farm, and the rest of those workers are now doing something else and making us all richer. So we need to think about doing that across the board in the economy, and the best way to do that is through technological innovation. And so, for example, technologies like robotics or artificial intelligence, material science. Imagine if scientific research could develop roofing shingles that lasted 100 years. I just had my roof replaced. I think it was probably 30 years old, which is about the life cycle of roofing asphalt materials. Imagine if they could last 100 years. We wouldn't have so many people fixing roofs, and they could be doing other things. So we need to drive more innovation to improve productivity, and yet there's no real mission of that in the federal government. Federal mission for R&D is things like defense or energy or health. So what we're calling for in the report, just to summarize and finish, is essentially ramping up federal support for research and development by $40 billion a year over 10 years and focusing that on the most important technology or scientific and engineering areas likely to boost productivity. As I said before, like microelectronics, advanced AI, artificial intelligence, advanced materials, et cetera, autonomous transportation systems, all these things could play a big role. If we do that, we estimate that we could really make a big dent in the debt-to-GDP ratio in 20 or 30 years.
And Dr. Atkinson, just to kind of go back a little bit there, you packed a lot of great things in that summary, and I'm looking forward to getting into some detail there. But I want to cover a few basics for our listeners first. You mentioned that from your perspective, and I happen to agree that the debt to GDP ratio is one of the most important ratios to keep track of. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, you know, you think about a little country or a smaller country like Canada. You know, there's no way they could afford our budget deficits, annual budget deficits, or having a $16 trillion national debt. It would sink them. Nobody would invest in Canada. They would be bankrupt. They would have to default. But so far the U.S. can't afford that because our economy is 9 times, 10 times bigger than the Canadian economy. So we have to think about not just the amount of debt, but the amount, the ability to pay it off. The analogy would be if you're making $50,000 a year, you can't afford probably $1 million home. But if you're making $500,000 a year, you can't afford $1 million home. So the more we can raise GDP, in other words, going from $50,000 income to a $500,000, to use that as an analogy, the more debt we can afford to manage responsibly and continue to pay off. So that's why the debt to GDP ratio is really a pretty critical ratio to be thinking about.
And in terms of its critical nature, do you think we're at a relatively safe level right now? I think it's close to 80% of debt to GDP, or is it more about the path we're on and where we're headed in that level?
Well, it's one of those things that we will know it when we see it. I'm not a budget expert. I focus more on innovation and technology policy, so Bob can answer that. But, so far it seems like it's okay. Who knows? The financial markets could decide tomorrow that it's not. But so far they seem like they're saying, no, this is okay. The real challenge, though, is where we're going. As I said, according to CBO, that's going to go to about 100% by 2028. By the 2040s, it'll be closer to 200%. Then you're getting into very uncharted territory with lots and lots of risk. Who knows? Maybe it'll still work, but do we really want to, run that risk for our country to be saying, well, we're going to roll the dice and hope that works, and we're not going to have massive inflation or defaults or other financial problems. So I think, so far we have a little bit of time, but, now is the time to act. These things take a long time to work their way out, whatever the solution is. And Concord Coalition has a whole series of reports laying out multiple solutions. But they all are going to take time to, kick in and see results in terms of the debt to GDP ratio. So, now is the time to get working.
And I do have just one more basic I want to cover before Bob probably jumps in with his probably many questions about the report and things he wants to hone in on. But you bounce back and forth between terms like economic growth and productivity growth. Can you distinguish the two for us and maybe explain the interplay between the two?
Sure. So the sort of accepted number, if you will, of how we measure the size of the economy is the gross domestic product, which is essentially a sum of everything we make. And then we add it all up at the end of the year, and we say this is how big the GDP is. The GDP is essentially how much we produced in a year. How many cars did we produce? How many podcast shows did we produce? How much food was sold? And you put that all together, and then you ascribe a number to it, a monetary number, and you get the GDP number, which is, as I said, around, it's like something around 18 trillion now, or close to that. Now, how does that grow? Well, it could grow really in two different ways. One is we could just work more hours. So imagine that everybody has to work an extra, 4 hours a week. You're working 40, now you're working 44. In theory, GDP would grow 10%. Or we could say we're going to expand immigration and have more people come here, and that's another way to grow GDP. But there's a sort of bottom-line way as opposed to a top-line way to grow GDP, and that's what if every person who was working produced 10% more every year? And that's productivity. So if you're making a car, let's just say the car company uses better technology so that you can make, 100 cars a day rather than 90 cars a day, that's productivity growth. And why is that so important? because there's a limit to sort of how much we can work. You know, most people don't want to be working overtime. There's a reason we have a 40-hour work week. People value leisure, and rightly so. There's a limit to sort of how long in our lives we can work. Our belief is we should all work longer, given the Social Security and Medicare crisis. But still, you can only do so much with that. Productivity is essentially this free lunch, if you will. If we could all produce 50% more tomorrow, the GDP would be 50% bigger. And then for every dollar of added GDP, the federal government gets essentially 19 or 20 cents. So think about that. You know, if we produce $50 billion more a year, that means that federal revenues go up by $10 billion. So that's why boosting productivity growth is so important, because it'll get you a much, much bigger GDP growth. A good example of that is using the CBO estimates, the Congressional Budget Office, which is sort of the one level, the official estimator of productivity growth, at least certainly in the congressional side. They estimate that productivity growth, what's called labor productivity, how much each worker produces more every year, will grow at a rate of about 1.4% a year between now and 2049. It may sound like a lot or a little, but historically that's pretty low, actually. In the 60s and 50s, for example, productivity was growing about 3.5% a year. So imagine we could get up to 3.4% productivity growth a year. Instead of GDP being $31 trillion in 2049, GDP would be $57 trillion. That's an amazingly different number. So we're talking essentially about $26 trillion more in inflation-adjusted output that Americans could enjoy. And of that $26 trillion, 20% of that goes directly into federal tax revenues. Revenue. So, and also spending would go down because a lot of federal spending is means tested, and as people have more money, there's less need for them to be getting federal support. So it really is this pretty central way to help us get out of this federal debt to GDP crisis that we're going towards.
And Dr. Atkinson, you sort of anticipated my next question, which was really what level of economic growth or productivity growth would be necessary to make an impact in terms of reducing that debt to GDP ratio in this era of pretty high level spending and projected to stay that way for years to come. I think I just saw the CBO put out information that we hit a $1 trillion deficit in the first 10 or 11 months of the fiscal year, if I'm remembering correctly. Bob, you can correct me if I misread that. But you mentioned getting to a 3.4% labor productivity growth rate, and we're projected at about 1.4%. So is it realistic to get to 3.4%, and how do you do it?
Sure. So one of the problems, I think, with how a lot of macroeconomists and pundits and journalists look at GDP is they say, oh, there's a fixed rate of GDP growth, and you know, if it gets too fast, then supposedly we're, quote, overheating the economy and leading to inflation. That's really only true when you hold productivity growth constant. You know, if productivity growth grew at 10% a year, which it won't, but just hypothetically for the sake of argument, if it grew at 10% a year, then you know, GDP could grow at 11 or 12% a year without inflation, because the other 1 or 2% is related to new entrants joining the labor force. So the question is 3.4% realistic? Of course it's realistic. There's no inherent reason why we couldn't do that. The real important question is, are there enough opportunities for organizations? And I use that because it's not just private enterprises that will need to do this. Government itself, government enterprises, for example, our school system, our garbage pickup system, you name it, you know, all of our systems and our enterprises, our organizations are going to have to find a way to become more productive. But we argue in this paper that when you look at the evidence of how the relationship from studies that have been done by scholars, that a 1% increase in R&D stock, in other words, the amount of R&D that companies can use, raises productivity by 2.3%. So More R&D we do, particularly R&D focused on productivity, we could raise productivity. So I think it's certainly possible. You use an example in the report that the cost of rust, just simply oxidation of metals, costs the U.S. economy $400 billion a year. Now imagine if we could come up with, there really an amazing set of new breakthroughs possible in material science. What people have been calling the materials genome, and what they mean by that is the ability for the first time to sort of custom design materials as opposed to taking them out of nature and then, doing whatever chemical process you do with them. Imagine if we could really make a breakthrough there. We're saving $400 billion a year. Imagine if we could develop a paint that lasted not 10 or 20 years for your house, but 100 years. Imagine, for example, with robotics. Robotics is, to me, one of the most exciting technologies in the future. We could automate, for example, making hamburgers at McDonald's. We could automate trucking significantly. We could automate freight rail. So there are enormous set of opportunities that are in front of us, but we really do need to advance the science and the engineering better and faster. So I don't believe the famous economist Joseph Schumpeter, who was a Harvard economics professor in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and he's kind of the godfather of innovation economics. He had a famous quote where he said, "Technological innovation is an uncharted sea that will never end." So I don't believe that we're anywhere near the end of the ability to use science and engineering to just come up with amazing things that are going to transform our lives and make us all more productive. So I think it's certainly a moonshot. We should be focusing in that direction and trying as hard as we can to get there.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Dr. Rob Atkinson and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, who hasn't had a chance to chime in yet. So I'm going to roll it over to you, Bob, and just to give a quick reminder for our listeners, we're talking to Dr. Atkinson about his recent report that discusses focusing policy on federal R&D, prioritizing such efforts on driving growth to reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio. And, Bob, I think it's high time our listeners had a chance to hear from you.
Okay, well, I've been listening to Rob as fascinated as I'm sure the listeners were, too, because this is a subject that just doesn't get much attention, and it really should. And the reason that the Concord Coalition is happy to sponsor this research paper by Rob and others looking at economic growth and the key issues of the future is that we certainly have a budget problem, which the Concord Coalition talks about all the time, but increasingly we have an economic problem, and I'm not talking about the ups and downs of the business cycle, I'm talking about long-term economic growth, which is a lot different. The picture is different now than it was when the Concord Coalition started, when the boomers were in their peak earning years and we had higher productivity and we had a higher labor force growth. So we were worried almost exclusively about how the federal budget, the spending and tax policy, would affect the debt and hence economic growth over the long term. But I think it's time that we budget hawks also begin to look at what's going to affect the economy other than the debt over the long term because of the enormous slowdown in labor force growth and stagnant productivity that we've seen that really contributes to the problem of the long-term budget because if the economy is not growing as fast, then the budget, any level of debt is going to be worse in a slower growing economy, as Rob pointed out earlier. So this is the productivity piece of it, and I'd like to go just quickly on a baseline of, we've talked about the importance of it and now turn to sort of what does the federal government do and what should it be doing in this regard. Years ago, and I know there are different ways of measuring this, but back in those robust days that you mentioned before, Rob, it seems to me the federal government spent a lot more, a percentage of the budget, a lot more of the economy on R&D than it does now. Is that true that we've got sort of a long-term decline in the trend of what government does in this area?
It absolutely is, Bob. You know, you all obviously know, and the listeners know about the Sputnik response. You know, if you watch Apollo 11, that movie, you see that very vividly. And it was a wake-up call in the 57, I guess, where the Russians launched this this satellite, and we were taken aback. And so the country, on a bipartisan basis, said, wait a minute, we can't let the Russians beat us, either symbolically or real way on technology. So it was really the launch of a new era where the federal government significantly boosted R&D, support for scientific research and engineering through NASA, through DOD, through the National Science Foundation and the like. And that really went through all the way through President Reagan, and then it stopped, and then it's become back down, at least from a R&D to GDP ratio. So right now, the U.S. government, the federal government, spends less on research and development as a share of GDP than before Sputnik. We'd have to be investing about $130 billion more a year. We have to essentially double what we're doing. So, you know, you can say, well, what difference does it make? Problem in terms of what difference it makes is, you know, one of the reasons the U.S. became the world leader in technology, and we spent more in the 60s, the federal government was spending more in the 60s on R&D than every single country combined, business and government. So you take every single foreign company, every single foreign government, and the U.S. government alone was spending more on scientific research and engineering. And that's why we got the great lead we had, and that's the reason our lead is slipping right now, and it's also the reason, Bob, as you point out, that the rate of labor productivity growth in the last decade has been probably the lowest in American history. We really only started measuring it in 1947, but probably the lowest in American history. And that's a big reason why people, I think, are upset and frustrated, and why wages aren't growing as fast, because we're just not producing more or being more productive. So, yes, absolutely, the federal government plays a key role in that. And the key part of the paper really is to say, you know, let's target more of that. Let's invest more, but let's target it at areas where we think could have the biggest bang for the buck in terms of driving economic growth.
And I think that's really a key point of this paper is, you know, just as a budget hawk, I can maybe say mea culpa for the budget community in the sense that, you know, when we talk about cutting spending, that doesn't mean cutting all spending, just chopping across the board. And I think that one of the unfortunate consequences of deficit reduction efforts is that because the major entitlement programs and defense spending tend to be sacrosanct, and so people don't want to go after them. They have powerful constituencies. And the part of the budget that really gets whacked is non-defense discretionary spending, which is the part of the budget. It's only, what, about 15-16% of the budget. And that's the part where you find most of the R&D spending. And so it's kind of a function of the budget process as well that we haven't done that. And I think, you know, it is important. One of the key points in the paper is that you don't want to just, on the other hand, turn on the spigot and say, well, you know, the more we spend on R&D, anything goes, and get the money out there. It's really making federal R&D, making it a specific mission. And I really like that part of the paper, and I hope we can talk a little bit more about how you do that. But making it a mission to target R&D on the things that will have the most bang for the buck, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. I couldn't agree more. Obviously, it's not just a question of throwing more money at the problem. It's less, you know, and nor is it unlimited amount of money. I mean, really, you know, $40 billion might sound like I was ramping it up $4 billion each year, adding, so you go four,
and
then eight.
That's the recommendation, is like $40 billion a year over 10 years in the context of the federal budget.
Right.
Significant, but not, you know, I mean, that's not like, oh my God, we can't. People throw out proposals like that at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the, not to be partisan, but you look at some of the proposals in the among some of the Democratic candidates, and you know, $40 billion is a drop in the bucket for some of the things that the, you know, you look at their...
Yeah, more like a rounding error at this
New Deal
point
thing,
in the budget.
They're talking trillions of dollars.
Yeah. Or the tax cut proposals on the other side.
Absolutely. You know, one of the, to make that point, one of the recommendations in the paper is to also increase the research and development tax credit. Now, this is a credit that President Reagan launched and saw to come to fruition in his first term, where we give companies a tax credit, essentially about 7% essentially, on when they spend money on R&D. And then the economists are very clear about why we do that, because companies, even though they try to keep it in-house and they might patent something, they can't do it. It's in term economists call spillover. So a company might try to invent something, but other companies learn how to use it, or they reverse engineer it, or there's a scientific article that one of their employees writes. Anyway, we've estimated that if we expanded the research and development tax credit and doubled it, that it would actually pay for itself over a 15-year budget window. Because it would lead to more R&D, more economic growth, more federal revenues. Now, the problem is that CBO doesn't have a 15-year budget window when they do these things. And so, you know, our view, again, when you look at the modeling we've done in the paper, this actually does just vastly more than pays for itself. You got to wait a while till everything kicks in and you get growth. But it certainly, if you do it right, it would definitely pay for itself and way beyond that.
And I think this is as good a time as any, Dr. Atkinson, to go into a little more detail. I think you have 8 different overarching policy recommendations within the report. You just mentioned one. Can you give a summary of the others and why you decided to utilize those particular tools or policy options?
Sure. So some of them are kind of, you know, core changes, like expand the research and development tax credit. Another is to, over a 10-year period, ramp up federal funding for R&D by $40 billion in year 10. But the most important part of that, as Bob alluded to, is target that to areas where we think are going to have the biggest potential to drive productivity. A third component of that is we believe that some of that money should be done in partnership with industry. And so, for example, we have a set of these manufacturing R&D institutes in the U.S. where they're looking at, I'll give you an example, the first one that was created was on 3D printing, or what's called additive manufacturing. This is a pretty amazing technology, the ability to print, you know, different parts. People actually are now experimenting using 3D printing to build houses. Now imagine if we could get 3D printed built houses. You would easily increase construction productivity by an order of magnitude. I'm sorry, not by a factor of 2 or 3 or even 4. So, you know, look at construction productivity. This is an industry in the U.S. that employs millions and millions of workers, and yet it has shown zero productivity growth over the last 30 years. Zero. One of the reasons why houses are expensive, because they just keep getting more and more, there's no productivity to offset the increase of inflation. So imagine if we could develop 3D printing that would allow houses to be 3D printed. You know, you're not going to get every single component of it, but a lot of it. Well, one of the reasons why Congress and the administration created these centers was to work on the early stage research, but in partnership with industry, so we're working in this as well. So part of it is to build on that kind of model around productivity research. And then the second main area really is around making sure that the federal government, including the White House, has better alignment and coordination. So, for example, one of the things that we recommend the White House do is require all agencies that fund research, so that's a lot of different agencies, the Department of Agriculture funds research, the Department of Transportation, obviously the Defense Department, National Institutes of Health, you name it, but they should be doing their own analysis of where the research investment's going to be that have the biggest impact on productivity. You know, one of the interesting things about doing this report, which I take the opportunity to thank Bob and the Concord Coalition for their support for enabling us to do this, we looked around the world and said, has anybody ever done this before? Has anybody ever looked at what are the opportunities that have the biggest bang for the buck in terms of research driving productivity? And the answer was no. We could not find a single exercise to have done that. So that's one of the things that we suggest that the OSTP, Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, conduct that analysis and really work with scientists and engineers to identify the areas that are likely to have the biggest bang for the buck. So those are some of the kinds of initiatives that we propose.
And Dr. Atkinson, you mentioned earlier on, you used the construction industry sort of as an example and how there's been an incredible lack of productivity growth in that whole industry. But it also employs millions of people. And part of me wonders, is there any connection there? Meaning, is the lack of productivity growth what enables millions of people to be employed in that industry? And if we go the route of focusing on R&D from the federal level and really advancing technology in different industries, is that going to result in a high level of displacement in terms of workers? And what do we do if that's the case?
So you hit the nail right on the head. This is, and we address that in the report of saying here are some of the concerns that we would expect people to raise. One of them, obviously, is job impact. What's interesting, though, if you look at the evidence, and McKinsey Global Institute, for example, did a nice analysis on that. They went back and they looked at what's the correlation between productivity growth in 1 year and job growth in the next year, or productivity growth in a decade and job growth in that decade. And what you find is that periods of high productivity in U.S. history, at least in the 20th century, are correlated with periods of low unemployment. So it's exactly the opposite of what most people would think. Oh, we've laid off some construction workers, we should have high unemployment. In fact, the opposite occurs. And the reason the opposite occurs is because when you have a high productivity economy, like we did, for example, in parts of the 80s and the 90s, companies are feeling very optimistic. Hey, productivity is growing. My costs are coming down. I'm going to invest more. I'm going to build new products. I'm going to design new products, new factories. Workers feel more optimistic and confident. They're going to spend more. The government has more money, so they invest more in roads or whatever it might be. So the thing that we should not worry about is we're not going to run out of jobs. It's what people forget sometimes, it's easy to forget it if you live in Washington where the living standards are so high and the cost of living is so high. But the median household income in the United States is only $60,000. Let's just say hypothetically that through this approach we could double GDP within 30 years, 25 years. We're only at $120,000 per household. I guarantee you go out and ask a typical American household, hey, if we doubled your income from 60 to 120, would you run out of things to spend money on? They would laugh at you.
I wouldn't.
No, you know, and everybody's going to differ. You know, you might want to go and, you know, buy a small boat, you know, so on the weekends you can go out fishing, or, you know, you might want to buy some better furniture for your house or add on a deck or save more for your kids' college, whatever it is. We're not going to run out of things to do. The big issue, or I should say the issue that I think has some we should be concerned about, and that's, well, if you were to accomplish this agenda, I think there's no question that there would be more economic dislocation, or what economists call labor market churning. But what we have to again remember, let's go back to the 90s. In the 90s, the odds of you losing your job from a company downsizing because of productivity was significantly lower than today. Significantly higher than today. So it was a lot, you know, back in the 90s, you had a higher, much higher risk of losing your job because of automation than you do today or other factors. And yet, the unemployment rates were as low, if not lower, and more importantly, wage growth was a lot higher. So workers back in the 60s, like, I might lose my job, but the economy's booming, and so I'm going to go and get another job. And by the way, it's probably going to be a pretty good job. So if we can get to this high productivity economy, then we also get to an economy that's just doing well. It's growing. It's people are investing. People feel good. And then the real question becomes, how do we make sure that construction worker has the skills and capabilities they need to move into something else. You know, we're, by the way, we're never going to run out of sort of manual repair kinds of things. I mean, an example I use right now in my life is my refrigerator. There's a little cam on the bottom of the door that so when you open the door, it automatically shuts itself. But over time, those wear out. So I've ordered a new cam, and I've got to take the refrigerator door off and install it. You know, I do that because I know how to do it, and I like doing it. But most people, well, just you'd hire a repair person to do it. There's no way that a robot can ever do that. It's just way, way too complicated for a robot to ever do that. So there's still going to be lots and lots of work for people who use their hands. There'll be work for people who use their mind. There'll be people who, you know, are in the caring economy, if you will. So we're not going to run out of work. It's really just a question of, can we do a better job of making sure that workers can make transitions successfully?
And interestingly, we have a paper on that too. Because one of the other papers in the series is about changing worker training in this changing workforce environment. So we can talk about that, I guess, in a future show.
That's super important. I'll just add that other paper is really important for two reasons. The more skills workers have already on the job, the easier it is for them to move to a new job. The workers that have the hardest time moving to a new job are ones that don't have hardly any skills. And so the paper that Bob is supporting is going to make, I think, a very important contribution to that. But the second part of that is, as we move to more better technologies, a lot of those technologies are going to require workers to have complementary skills that are better and, you know, more sophisticated than what they have today. And so I think we need to look at this as kind of, we're going to go down this one path around technology, we'll go down a similar path around worker skills. Together, they'll produce even more than one would do on their own.
And I have so many more questions. This is a topic that I think we could spend several shows discussing, but unfortunately we're out of time. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Dr. Robert Atkinson, President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, ITIF. We discussed Dr. Atkinson's recent paper explaining why federal R&D policy needs to prioritize productivity to drive growth and reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio. Thank you both for joining the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We'll be back after these short messages with our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. While we are in the thick of the appropriations process, it's a good time for a reminder that the rapid and persistent growth of mandatory spending and interest means the budget debate is increasingly focused on a shrinking portion of the budget. Federal spending can be divided into three main categories. The first category is mandatory spending, which is spending that operates on autopilot based on benefit formulas approved by lawmakers long ago. Mandatory spending makes up about two-thirds of the budget and includes major programs like Social Security and Medicare. The second category is interest on the debt, which, like mandatory spending, is largely on autopilot. The cost of interest is determined by both the amount of debt incurred by the federal government to finance deficits and the cost of that borrowing as determined by interest rates. The final category of spending is discretionary spending, which is comprised of all the programs that Congress appropriates money for on an annual basis. This includes most defense spending, as well as all domestic spending on non-entitlement programs. Discretionary spending is the one area of spending that policymakers have the most control over, and as such, it draws the most attention in annual policy debates. The problem is that discretionary spending is shrinking as a share of the total budget. As recently as 1974, discretionary programs comprised a majority of federal spending, but today, discretionary spending accounts for less than one-third of the federal budget, and under current law, it is projected to fall to just one-quarter in less than a decade. This phenomenon is partially due to the fact that the first two categories of federal spending, mandatory and interest, are projected to grow faster than the third. As these programs grow in size, they're also consuming a greater share of federal spending. But discretionary spending is not just falling relative to mandatory spending, it is also falling relative to the size of the economy. In fact, discretionary spending is already below its historic average as a share of GDP, and that fall is expected to continue. Policymakers are increasingly focused on how to divide up this shrinking third of the pie, pitting smaller programs against each other for resources instead of addressing the real drivers of our nation's long-term fiscal challenges. Such short-sightedness threatens important government functions like national defense and investments in our future, like infrastructure, education, and scientific research. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.